And Julien, over to you.
Okay, well, hi everyone, and thanks Boyo for the invitation and for the too generous introduction. So this is joint work with Florence Forbes, Ian Nguyen, and Chung Tin Nguyen. And what I'm going to talk about today is approximate Bayesian computation, that is ABC in short, with surrogate posteriors. So it's a new sort of a new way to doing ABC that we find pretty interesting. So as a disclaimer, I'd like to say first that none of us is really expert of ABC, but anyway we find the new methods are pretty cool. So here are my collaborators. So Florence is the head of the Statify team in INRIA Grenoble. Ian Nguyen is at La Trobe University in Australia, and Chung Tin Nguyen is at Caen University in France. So I think that all of them are here. So hi, guys. So by the end of my presentation, you should be more familiar with ABC, I hope. So I will start by presenting the vanilla algorithm that you can use in ABC that is called rejection ABC. And then I'll move on to the semi-automatic approach that was proposed by Fernand and Prangle in 2012. And what we do is that we built on this semi-automatic ABC. So we have a preliminary learning step where we built what we call surrogate posteriors. And these surrogate posteriors are built as an inverse regression that is called GLIM. And so we call our ABC approach the GLIM ABC procedure. So I will present some theoretical properties of it and a number of illustrations in inverse problems. And then I conclude. So to give you quickly some context, when we are interested in doing Bayesian inference, but the likelihood is intractable, one way to deal with is the context of approximate Bayesian computation. So you get a data generating model as follows. So the parameter is denoted theta, and we have a prior pi theta. And given on theta, the likelihood is denoted f theta of z. So z is d-dimensional. And an important condition of ABC is that we know who to sample from this likelihood. We also know who to sample from the prior. So the goal of statistics, one goal in statistics is estimation. So estimation of the parameter given some observed y. And in Bayesian stats, how this is done is by forming a posterior distribution by theta given y that is proportional to the prior times the likelihood. And the question is in ABC, what to do when the likelihood is intractable. So it's not possible to evaluate it, maybe because it's too costly or just because it's not there. So one way to proceed, and the most simple way to do is as follows. So you get to, you want some theta values, some parameter values from the posterior, but you're not going to have them exactly from the posterior in an ABC setup. It's going to be approximate. And so the way to proceed is as follows. You need to sample quite a lot, a number M of couples of parameters and sampled data, theta M and ZM. And so this is simple to do if you know how to sample from both the prior and the likelihood. You can first sample theta values from the prior, and conditional on these theta values, sample data values from the likelihood. And the key starting point of rejection ABC is that you are going to accept or to keep parameter values for which you simulated data values that are close to the actual data. And so this is done by a comparison with some metric capital D. And as soon as the distance is small enough, then you decide to keep the parameters that you have sampled. So this distance d can take several forms. In the most simple way, it takes it's the Euclidean distance between the vectors of data, of true data and simulated data. But as we will see, it's also often the Euclidean distance of summaries of these vectors. So already now we can see a number of questions. We are faced with a number of questions, actually. What choice for D, for the distance, for the summaries, and also for the threshold epsilon. So in this talk and in our work, we don't really discuss the choice of the threshold, but we have this discussion on the choices for D and for the summaries. So there are a number of strategies for these choices of D and S. So it's a starting point for this is the realization that you cannot really use this simple Euclidean distance efficiently in high dimension. It's you would get too much variability in your procedure. So it's important to reduce the dimension. So doing this can be done in two ways. The first category of ways, the first family of procedures is based on the effort is made on the summary. So D in this family of approaches is a standard Euclidean distance. And in this way, the fact that you use summaries reduces the dimension and induces a smaller variance, but the problem is that you lose some information and the choice of the summaries is still arbitrary if you don't have expert information for how to do it. So the work that I already mentioned a couple of minutes ago by Fernand and Prangle in 2012 provided the first solution to this problem. So the semi-automatic ABC framework relies on a preliminary learning step where you learn the dependence between the parameter and the data in a generic way. But one of the limitations is that it requires a modest dimensionality for the data. And the second category of approaches is the ones that are based on data discrepancy. So it was an active research line in the last 5 years or so, where the idea here is to replace the distance by a distance on empirical distributions. So you view in this sort of approaches, you view your data vectors as empirical distributions. So by doing this, so here it's with some abuse of notation, the vectors are seen as these empirical distributions, and then you can use distances between empirical distributions. So a number of distances have been proposed in the literature, and they are listed here. So a clear advantage is that you do not rely anymore on any summary stats, but a problem is that it requires moderately large samples. You need replicates of samples for the same parameter to inverse. And in many inverse problems, you don't have these replicates. So in the problems we are interested in, you only have one observation that can be a long observation, but you have one observation to inverse for every parameter of interest. Okay, so one reason why these ABC methods are interested, and one of the reasons why we can count on them, is that they have well-behaved limits when epsilon goes to zero. So this is what we present here. This is the posterior distribution is written with this intractable likelihood in red. And so since it's intractable, we replace it, ABC replaces it by this blue quantity that is convolution of the likelihoods with respect to the indicator function here in blue, okay? So using this approximate likelihood induces an approximate posterior here in red that is proportional to the prior times the approximate likelihood. And the reason why this quasi posterior converges to the true posterior is fairly simple to see. It relies on the fact that when epsilon goes to zero, the distances between the data vectors also goes to zero. So the set of accepted vectors converges to the singleton made of only true data y. And so the approximate posterior converges to the true posterior. So the details of this proof can be found in the references below. And one of the starting point of the work is actually a realization by Florence, if I don't want to mention her, that this condition that the set of accepted Zs converges to the singleton Y is somehow too strong of an assumption, or you can rely on something not as strong as this for the convergence to still hold. And let me explain in which sense this is true. So we can write the base formula for the quasi posterior in a slightly different way. So we replace here the joint of theta and data by the same joint here written in blue, but by using the chain rule in the other way around, right? So it uses the posterior and the evidence of Z. And so this is a sort of a first realization. And then the second sort of bold endeavor is to replace some distance between vectors Y and Z by distances between posterior distributions. So here there is an overload of the notation. D is not the same D, but we use still the same notation. So in this integral, we want to replace distance between vectors by a distance between distributions. We are forming a new quasi posterior that is written in blue. That is the same as before, but where the indicator function is evaluated at the distances above. Okay, and when first theorem that we prove in the preprint is the fact that the quasi posterior converges to the exact posterior, to the true posterior in total variation when epsilon goes to zero. So actually the proof is very similar to the intuition of the original proof for other ABC structure. When epsilon goes to zero, you can get that the discrepancy between the surrogate between the posteriors also goes to zero. So that means that the posterior evaluated at Z converges to that evaluated at the true data. And in terms of quasi posteriors, that means that the quasi posterior also converges to the posterior. And so what we see in blue here is that the convergence now in terms of set of indicator functions is a convergence to a set that is potentially slightly larger than the singleton Y. This set in blue here contains Y, but not necessarily only Y. So if you follow me well, you may ask yourself, why is it any legitimate to use this unknown quantity in what we do? And so, of course, in practice, we need to use tractable approximations to these posteriors. And this is what we call the surrogate posteriors. So I'm moving now to give a few words on the approach proposed by Fernand and Prangle. So what they do in semi-automatic ABC is to replace the choice of summaries by the posterior mean. So of course the posterior mean is a quantity that is unavailable by definition of your problem. This is one of the things that you are looking for. But their idea, and they suggest, to use a preliminary linear regression to learn this mapping between theta and z. And this is done by first simulating a large number of couples of parameters and data that is simply sampled from the joint distribution. So it's the same procedures that what we do in ABC, but it's done as a preliminary step, right? So in the end, you're going to do it twice. And so we have a number of contributions in the paper that we call variants in this presentation. So I realized that I should not use the word variant, that is too much connoted those days. So the first one was already implemented by papers, for instance, Jiang and Wiquist, and it was already suggested in the original paper by Denis and Paul. It's about using something else than a linear regression, so neural networks, for instance. Actually, we can also use our own inverse regression to implement variant number one. Then variant number two is to realize that not only the mean could be used, but also some higher order moments like variances. So it was already suggested by Jiang, but not implemented. And we guess that the reason why it was not implemented is that it requires your procedure to be able to provide those moments at low cost. And the main contribution is variant number three, is to replace summaries by a wall approximation of the posterior. So this requires two things. It requires a learning procedure that is able to provide these approximate posteriors. And for this, we use the GLIM model, Gaussian locally linear mapping, of Delforge 2015. And then once we have a posterior approximation, we need a way to compare them. And this is this requires metric between distributions. So I have to stop maybe for a couple of seconds to ask whether there are any questions on what we've seen so far before I move to our proposed ABC framework. I shall move on. So the surrogate posteriors that we propose are built as mixtures of Gaussians. So this is one of the babies of the first author of the work by Florence. And the idea of GLIM is to capture the relationship between data and parameters as a mapping that we learn beforehand. So the way the mapping works is as a mixture of Gaussian distributions that are parametrized by a number of by two sets of parameters. Let's say the first set of parameters rely on the weights of the mixtures here below, while the second half of the parameters rely on how we parameterize the Gaussians. And there is this affine relationship of the means. and affine dependence in Y. So to fit this GLIM model, we need a preliminary learning set, just as the semi-automatic approach does. So for this, we need to sample from the true joint N capital N couples. And then the GLIM relationship is learned by using an EM algorithm. Okay, so we estimate a phi star K for the number of mixtures and for the number of components and N for this data size. And we estimate phi star, and then all the procedure that follows can be done with this this single value of phi star. So in our case, the three variants that I have presented before take the following form. If I rely on GLIM, the variant number one uses the posterior mean as a single summary statistic, and so posterior means are obtaining closed form for GLIM model. Everything is in closed form with these Gaussian mixtures. So this is the mean that we use. Variant number two is the suggestion that we can add some higher order moments. So it happens that the variances are also closed form for GLIM, and they take this form. And then the variant number three is the idea that we can use surrogate posteriors. So the full surrogate posterior in the case of GLIM are mixtures of Gaussians. So if we want to use this as quantities to be compared together, we need metric for Gaussian mixtures. And that's precisely the work that was done by Delon and Desaulneux in last year paper, where they propose a Wasserstein-based distance for mixtures of Gaussians. So the distance is referred to as the MW2. But other distances can be used, and we also implement an L2 distance between mixtures. Okay, so this is a recap of the proposed algorithms. So remember that we have a first preliminary learning step where we need to sample a large sample N data set. And we learn GLIM on this data set. So we learn this functional relationship between theta and Z by getting a phi star hyperparameter estimate. This is an approximation of the true posterior. And then there is the second step that is computing distances. So we need another simulated data set, E capital M, for a single observed Y. And we can do two different approaches, the vector approach that is either variant one or variant two, with only expectation or with expectation and variances or log variances. And the functional summary variant consists in comparing directly the surrogate posteriors, so either by the MW2 or by the L2. And then the sample selection is the usual thing that you only retain the smallest distances by choosing epsilon as a quantile of the empirical distribution of the distances. Okay, so I'm moving now to some asymptotic properties of our procedures. I can take questions if there are. Otherwise, I'm happy to move on.
It looks like there's a question from Jeff. Jeff, if you'd like to just unmute yourself and go ahead.
Hi, yeah. Sorry, the window's open. I just wanted to ask, I just want to check my understanding. The Y vector there is quite a high dimensional. It's not just a D-dimensional object. It includes like the whole data set. Is that right? Or is it just a D-dimensional object?
It's a D-dimensional object. It's a D-dimensional vector that that is not that high in our applications. I'm going to comment on it later on, but it's usually, it can be up to 100 or 1,000 dimensional.
The full data set is not d-dimensional, right? The full, you have multiple copies of these, right?
Actually, not really. In the inverse problems that we are interested in, we have it's a specific setup where you have one, and you want the associated theta parameter for this data, for this single observation y.
Great. Thanks very much. I just want to check.
Thank you. Okay, so I've already mentioned the first result, theoretical result that we have, that is that the posterior converges to the true posterior when epsilon goes to zero, and this is not really an applied result because it relies on the fact that we use the exact posterior that we actually don't have. So this is more of a practical theoretical result, this one, because we plug the actual surrogates in the quasi posterior we are working with. So I have to acknowledge that this result does only hold on a restricted class of targets and surrogate distributions. So we need compactness actually for being able to prove the result. So compactness of both the joint space of theta and y, and as well compactness of the parameter psi that contains the phi parameters of our family of mixture components. So according to these assumptions, we built k component mixtures from the family capital H. We use this learning set Dn and compute, just as before, the MLE parameter as being this quantity that maximizes the log likelihood for phi. And the surrogates are built as the mixtures evaluated at this phi star. And what we can prove is with these under this framework, under some additional standard assumptions that I don't detail here, that the Ellinger distance between our approximate posterior and the exact posterior converges to zero. So in some measure lambda with respect to the data, to the true data y, and in probability with respect to this sample dn, or yes, dn. So an important caveat of our result is that GLIM actually do not satisfy these compactness assumptions, but we hope that some mixture of truncated Gaussian distributions could actually meet these restrictions. So what I want to say is that this theoretical result does not directly apply to GLIM. So I'm now moving to a couple of, there is a, yes, Judith, question by Judith.
So is it important to work with the Hellinger distance?
I guess it's important to work with the distances where you know how to deal with.
Because the Hellinger distance sort of is a strong distance. So maybe you only need a weak distance.
Yes, I see. Yeah, that's a good point.
Which might avoid the compactness assumption.
Yeah. So for sure, we were not able to avoid this assumption with. We did not see how to avoid it, even with other function, other distances. But it's probably a direction to try to investigate more. Yes, that's a good point. Okay. Thank you. So I'm moving to illustrations where we have two examples with multimodal posteriors. So one point to keep in mind is that our approach is deemed to work best when in the case of multimodal posteriors. So this is a reason why we focus essentially on these examples. So in the both examples, we have two 10-dimensional observation, and that's a single observation. So in the maybe a follow-up of a Geoff question is that in the case where the actual observation is like a very long observation, maybe it can be just summarized to a smaller dimension observation. And the first example is a synthetic sound source localization with 2D parameters. And the next one is a real inverse problem of 4D parameters. So we compare four types of ABC models. The one that is based on GLIM with only the expectation, GLIM with the expectation and the variance, GLIM with functional summaries, so either with comparing by L2 or by MW2, and then the Fanad and Prangle semi-automatic ABC. So for each of them, we rely on R packages. And the same for GLIM, we rely on this XLIM package that was proposed by Florence and co-authors. Judith?
Yeah, sorry, I'm asking. So you're not comparing directly with GLIM, because in a sense, you're obtaining approximation of a posterior.
So we do compare to GLIM as well. That's a really good point. I should have listed it, because it's a totally legitimate question. You start with an approximation of the posterior, so maybe you could stop there, and we can see that we get an extra. We find this approximation with the ABC step, at least in our examples. So this is setting for GLIM, and then we do only rejection ABC. We suspect that we could also do some other sort of ABC algorithms. So the numbers are as follow: n is 10 to the 5, and the number of ABC iterations is 10 to the 5 as well, or 10 to the 6, and the epsilon is a 0.1% quantile. So this first application it arises from the case where you have a source localization. You want to infer the localization of a sound source. So it's just a 2D parameter. You want X and Y based on a number of sound measurements. And the sound measurements, one way to get them through some devices is this ITD. So I guess that this is a bit also how the ears work, is that you have a pair of microphones, and from this pair of microphones located in M1 and in M2, you are able to compute this ITD function that depends on the parameter theta. The problem is, maybe it's not a problem, but that's the way it is. You have a whole hyperboloid of solutions, or actually two whole hyperboloids of solutions. So how we sample, that's a simulated example. So we sampled observations in the following way. We assume a single theta, but we assume that we observe Ys that are student T noised versions of the ITD. So this is ITD plus some student noise with a quite small variance and one degree of freedom. So this is not this is a really really bad noise with no expectation. And so the dimensionality is 10. So actually, this is not exactly this illustration that I show here. It's a slightly different one where we still have one true position to discover, but instead of using one pair of microphones, we use two pairs. And the microphones are located, so one on the x-axis, one the other one pair of the y-axis. And so the likelihood in such a model is an equal weight mixture of the two single pair components. And so this is the shape of the true posterior. We can easily find the shape by working with the ITD function. This exhibits four symmetric hyperbolas. And actually, we can also use a Metropolis-Hastings algorithm to sample from the posterior, but we see here that it's not doing really great. Maybe this is because we didn't tune it well enough. And so speaking about the results now, so we have these, let's start by the GLIM mixture in red in the bottom left. This is to reply to Judith's question. So this is what we get with only the preliminary learning step. And we see that we have, we probably see those Gaussian components here. We have a number of them, maybe something like 8 or maybe a bit more. But it's not a perfect representation of the posterior. Then I want to move to the two occurrences of variant number one, that is GLIM E ABC and the semi-automatic ABC. So they are not doing okay at all. And then we have the last three that are doing quite okay for the three of them. The expectation variance is doing maybe something a bit intermediate due to values that we see in the middle. It's a bit more spread of posterior. And so this is variant number two. And then the variant three, the functional posterior one, is doing really, really good, I think, and quite similar. For both cases.
Can I ask another question? So there is something I don't understand. So you have you construct first table to learn your GLIM.
Yes.
And then you use a second table to do the ABC.
Yes.
If you had merged the two tables together and you had done just one GLIM, you'd get something better than the left hand side on the bottom, no? So would you do as good as the blue, or what do you think? Because somehow you have more data on the right for your GLIM thing.
Yes. So this reminds me of discussions that we had with our co-authors. Maybe I have some help from the co-authors in the chat. So I don't know. So actually Yen was replying to your first question. So maybe you can have a go to the chat for that. And yes, Florence says that you can also use a single table instead. So I guess she did try the GLIM mixture by merging the two. And I agree that you're gonna get something better than what we have represented here, but you're not going to something as precise as the GLIM version there. GLIMD, the function. Also, in a sense, if you want to spare some time to save some computation time, I guess that you could also learn both models on the same learning set. But maybe that wouldn't be very Bayesian. Okay. So I have a second and last illustration that comes from planetary science. There is an inverse problem. And the idea is to recover parameters from the surface of a planet, for instance, Mars surface, from what is called reflectance observations, reflectance measurements. So this is a typical inverse problem because it's the direct model is easy. So you know this relationship between, you know how to get the reflectance y based on some parameter x, small dimension parameter x, and you get only noisy measurements of these quantities. And so in our application, we focus on a small number of parameters, only those four. I have to say, I don't know what they mean. And the reflectance is high dimensional, but you can use only, you can do with only 10 geometries of these reflectance. So you can really compact the your observations to something quite small. And in this case, so the parameters that are used are given above. So 40 components in GLIM in the mixtures, and both capital N and capital M are equal to 10 to the 5, and epsilon is again the same quantile. So this is also a simulated example where the sets of parameters were decided equal to this. So they are meaningful in for the particular application that we set, because Florence is also working with scientists on this in other projects. So she knows that these values make sense, and the example is devised in such a way that the theta value has this symmetry between two potential values. So both 0.15 and 0.42 make sense for the model. And if we look at these results for the marginals of each of the four parameters, we see that they are, so what we have here is only GLIM expectation, the both functionals with L2 and MW2 and the semi-automatic in green. So for most of the parameters, they are doing very similarly. They are maybe slightly more peaked in the for the W parameter, both the blue and the black, so meaning the two functional ones. And what is interesting in that is that again, when there is multimodality in the posterior, these are the two procedures, the functional ones are the ones that seem to recover the best. So the black has this bimodality as well as the blue, as again this bimodality that red and green do not really have, or maybe less pronounced. So we only show marginals, but the same can be seen from joint representations. I guess I need to conclude. So what we have worked on is building on the semi-automatic framework of Fernand and Prangle, but with this shift of paradigm, in the sense that we use the whole posteriors to compare observations instead of comparing summaries of observations. So this requires a tractable and scalable model to learn the surrogates. So GLIM is one such possible model. This works well, as I was saying, up to 100 or 1,000 dimensional observations, and it can deal missing data and latent variables. And then we also are able to, we need metric to compare them. So we've used L2 and MW2. First few results are that we don't need any more summary statistics. We have convergence results to the true posterior with this caveat that it's only working on a restricted class of models and that's it. And we have good performances when the posteriors are multimodal. It seems that the quality of the surrogate posterior is not critical in the experiences that we have had. So GLIM is doing okay, as we have seen. It's not a perfect approximation of the posterior, but it's already something good enough for our procedure to do something good. And on some other experiments that we have run, Wasserstein base seems more robust than L2. A number of perspectives are, so it's still very young, very, very fresh work, let's say. It's so there are a lot of improvements that we can think about. The choice of K for the moment is we have no information criterion to select the number of components. So we could think about some. We haven't assessed computation costs, but that's probably something to do. Doing more experiments and illustrations. Other metrics than L2 and MW2 could be thought of. Other learning scheme than GLIM. So one option that I was discussing with Geoff before the talk is, for instance, normalizing flows. That would probably do something interesting. That would be interesting to check. Also, ABC schemes than the vanilla rejection. So you can think about important sampling, MCMC or sequential Monte Carlo. We haven't spoken about threshold level. And also extending this to more than just one observation to inverse is clearly something that we want to think about. So we have a number of colleagues to thank: Guillaume Concam-King, Benoît Kugler, and Sylvain Doutet. And very, very quickly, I would like to pass this message to, I don't know if any students on top of Francesca are from the 2017 PhD cohort, but we have these open positions of postdocs at INRIA. So the subject can be anything related to the themes of the team, for instance, Bayes. Condition is that the defense is before the end of the year and application is really soon, before May 21st. So you can write us if you're interested. So I just finish with this slide of references, including ours. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Julien. You're getting a few virtual rounds of applause from the audience, I can see. Oh, yeah. We've got a few minutes for questions. So if anyone would like to question, either just put your hand up and unmute yourself. Jeff, I can see you were first, and then we'll have Judith with a follow-up.
Thanks very much, Julien. Very interesting. And so my question is that surrogate posterior Q, I think you call it, is it, what's the sort of necessary and sufficient, is it necessary or is it sufficient for Q to converge to pi? Is it necessary for the surrogate to converge in order for the Hellinger distance to converge?
I guess it's necessary. Yes, I would say. I might be wrong, but no idea whether it's sufficient. But
I was guessing you were going to say the other way around, that it's no? It's obviously sufficient, but perhaps it's not necessary.
Maybe if I can add something.
Florence, please.
No, yeah, I think you're right, Jeff. We just need that it's the surrogate posterior are sort of discriminative enough on the parameters. If let's say we have a biased estimation of the true posterior, if the, I don't know if we can say that, but if the bias is like constant somehow, when you compare the two biased estimation, the distance between those biased estimation would be the same as the distance between the true posteriors, and then I think it would work. But the problem is that in practice we don't know how to formalize this ID.
Great, thanks very much.
Yeah, I don't know if you have suggestions, but.
Yeah. Judith, would you like to connect?
So can you go back to your conclusion, because I can't remember my question, but just afterwards. So so you said that you want to extend to ID observations. I don't quite know what you mean by that, but somehow the Y that you consider as your observation could be anything. It could be ID observation, it could be a long vector or like a long time series, the replications of time series, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a structure. The only thing that you need is that you want to approximate the posterior by your whatever method you're using. So here the GLIM. But yes. Y could be Y1, Yn, or it could be big Y.
Yeah.
No, am I wrong?
What we do is heavily relies on the fact that for one parameter, we have only one observation, and the an IID sample of observations make it a different setup. And I don't know. So
is it because of your convergence result that you want it to, like, if you had some asymptotic as well, is the dimension of the observation somehow?
Maybe that has to do with the theory, but I think even in the actual implementation of what we do, we would have to think differently for building GLIM, for instance.
Yes, yeah, so in the way you fit GLIM is related to the fact that you have a specific structure on your Y in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying?
Yes. So yes, you will have, well, we would have to fit a GLIM model with in a sense with a Y that is no more just one observation, but a table of observations. So
no, but you don't, I mean, for me, a Y is if you have n ID observation, you can look at it as one observation as well, which is a big vector of observation.
Mm. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you're constructing your table as for each theta, you have a big Z.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fit your conditional distribution. You want to estimate the conditional distribution of theta given Z. In a sense, that's your GLIM model, huh? Which is a non-parametric estimator, or pseudo non-parametric estimator of P of theta given Z, in a sense.
Yes.
Z is a Z1, Zn, and with each Zi being complex, it doesn't, I mean, in practice, it makes sense, but in the way the methodology is derived, the principles should be the same, no?
Yeah, maybe we lose something in doing it in this way. So I see Florence saying that
it wouldn't be optimal. Yeah. You'd probably want to do something more clever. Maybe you wouldn't.
You're right in the sense that we could stack all the IID observation in one big vector, but then it's a bit it's a pity not to let GLIM know that they are IID.
Yes. So you want to take into account the structure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because if you use for instance. Discrepancy based method, that's exactly what they do. They know the data IID, and they know that they all come from the same theta. So
yes,
and so it would be not in favor of GLIM not to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And also the idea that it's easy to adapt. The current GLIM implementation is not made for IID, but it's just an EM algorithm, so it's not too difficult to adapt it.
Mm.
And also for computational reasons, also if you have a very, very big vector, then we, for instance, at the moment, we cannot handle D equal to a million or I don't know, whatever they use in discrepancy-based methods. They have D may not be that large, but they have a lot of repetitions.
It's a bit reminiscent of something that Sylvia Frovishnatter was doing some years ago when she was using mixtures to approximate the posterior density in a sense within the MCMC algorithm. And I remember the talk, it was some years.
We have to check because indeed Sylvia worked a lot on mixture of experts and
I wonder how related it is to what you're doing. And I think in her case she could compute the likelihood, so it's a bit different in this respect, but she was definitely using these mixtures to approximate the posterior density at some stage in her algorithms.
Yeah.
And then maybe as a proposal for...
I can't remember whether it was a proposal or at the end, she didn't bother about getting rid of the proposal and she was just looking at these mixtures as an approximation. I'm not sure.
Mm. Yeah, it's worth checking. But it's likely to be related, I guess. Mm. Yeah, thanks. Because she has a full book on mixtures.
Yes. And she has an army of people working on that.
Yeah. I see that we are close to the end of the slot, but there was also another slot for one-on-one discussion. So I'm happy to stay connected to it's another Zoom link, I think. Brio, if
yeah. So if anyone
can open this one and then I stay there.
We're happy to continue the discussion here. But if anyone would like to chat with Julien one-on-one, just pop me a quick email, and we can set up the Zoom link to continue the discussion. But otherwise, I think we'll, unless there are any really quick questions, I think we'll call it a day here. So thank you everyone for attending, and thank you Julien for a really, really great talk.
Thanks again for the invitation.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. Everyone can look out for next week's talk. I can't remember who the speaker is, but there'll be of course another OxySML seminar for the next few weeks. So thank you again, Julien.
Thank you everyone. Bye-bye.
Right.